Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The Central Intelligence Agency is America's Department of Spying. They have the job to keep the nation safe by gathering information, analyzing it, and nowadays they also fly and attack with drones. So why would the CIA need lawyers? Well, in 1975, as a young lawyer, John Rizzo figured they might need some keen legal minds. He got hired and eventually became the top lawyer for the CIA. In his time at the agency, he saw the transformation of it from when America got attacked on 9/11 and also with the controversy over allowing waterboarding. And he's written about his experiences, his 34 years at the CIA, in a book called Company Man. Welcome to The Source, John Rizzo.
David, nice to be with you.
Let's talk about the title, Company Man. Of course, people colloquially, you know, in the media have called the CIA the company. Did people really call it the company inside the CIA?
No, ironically, David, I don't remember ever hearing it referred to as the company within those of us who were working in the company at the time. I took the title actually from an article that was written about me. Near the end of my career, and that's where it came from. It doesn't really have any basis in reality in terms of CIA.
How would you know, working Joes in the CIA refer to the agency?
Well, it was fairly simple. They would either call it the agency, or if you were working at Langley, it would be headquarters. Pretty straightforward, really.
But, you know, there's so many euphemisms, words that have multiple meanings at the CIA. And one of them, of course, is the enhanced interrogation technique. So that y'all use a lot of words to talk about one thing, but maybe it means something else, right?
Well, that was the, that was the way they were called when they were first presented to me as a proposal back in early 2002. So who came up with that particular euphemism, I can't tell you, but that's the first time I heard about them. That's how they were identified to me.
So let's talk about the law. As a lawyer, what is your relationship with the law? Do you have a great love for the law?
Well, I like the law. It's my profession. A lawyer at CIA, though, plays, I think, a unique role, certainly different from anyone in private practice and from anyone, really, in most federal agencies. The fact of the matter is there aren't a lot of U.S. laws out there governing CIA or affecting CIA activities. So as a lawyer, what I found throughout my career was that you acted more as a counselor in the broader sense of the term, advising your clients, obviously first if there was some legal issue or legal problem, that was your first obligation. But most of the time you were providing advice the way a lawyer would do to a client who, you know, may want to do something that might be risky or politically sensitive, and you try to guide him in a way that he can effectively carry out the mission, but in a way that's careful and well reasoned, and makes sense from a practical and operational standpoint. So it's a little different than just applying laws.
So it's as a lawyer for the CIA, it's not so much about what's legal and illegal, but it's about how to work. Not exactly within the framework of the law, but how to work alongside the law.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. How people can get the mission done in a way that's not just legal, but makes sense from a policy standpoint or a risk standpoint. It's that kind of role, and it's an invigorating role to have for a lawyer, of course, because you can be very creative and imaginative, but it also, of course, carries certain risks as well.
Right. But we live in a society of laws, and we need the rule of law to work as a society. So how does the CIA figure in with the rule of law if laws don't exactly, many, many laws don't apply to the CIA?
Well, first of all, the CIA is required to follow any and all U.S. laws that do apply to CIA. As I said earlier, there, point of fact, there aren't all that many, but first and foremost, we cannot violate U.S. law. Now, international law, small letters international law, is some tenets of international law, frankly, are inconsistent with what a intelligence organization does, spying overseas, collecting information on foreigners. So the fulcrum of a CIA lawyer's attention is on the extent U.S. laws apply. International law, frankly, is not a huge huge factor, not just for the CIA, but I dare say any intelligence organization in the world. And I might know parenthetically the CIA. When I left CIA, I was heading an office that had 125 lawyers in it. By contrast, when I joined in 1976, I was the 16th lawyer hired. So lawyers really are an intrinsic part of the fabric of CIA, always have been, much more than any other foreign intelligence organization I ever dealt with over the years.
But you did not train in law school to be a CIA attorney. You had become a lawyer. You were part of the bar. Then you specifically thought, hey, why not the CIA? Was there a system shock for you to realize that this is going to be a completely different kind of law practice?
Yeah, it was. I mean, as I describe in the book, the situations one is presented with in CIA, the questions you're asked, have nothing to do, absolutely nothing to do, at least at the time I went to law school, with anything you could possibly learn in law school. I mean, it was a totally new departure for me. These days, many law schools teach courses in national security law, so things may be different now, but when I was going to law school in the early 70s, there was no course, no seminar one could take that could prepare you for the kind of issues one deals with at CIA.
So you were, in a sense, kind of, I don't want to say, making it up as you go along, but you were inventing this in process, right?
Yeah. A recent book review of my book indicated that the reviewer that thought the impression was left that I was just basically winging it my entire career, making things up and making up rules as I went along. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but one does have to be creative in a situation. And really, there are no available precedents for it, or no prior court cases or to rely on.
Sure, so we're going to John Rizzo, former attorney for the CIA. We're going to his book, Company Man: 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis at the CIA. We're going to take a quick break. When I come back, I want to talk to you about what did you consider as you were breaking all this new ground? What were the priorities and your responsibilities as you were doing this? But we are going to take a quick break. Our phone lines are open. The number is 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with John Rizzo. He's written the book Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis at the CIA, former lead attorney for the CIA. So let me ask you, John, about that. As you were breaking the sod and figuring out how the agency was going to move forward, trying to accomplish these goals, what were your – and you had no rule book. What were your considerations? What were your responsibilities?
Well, aside first and foremost, obviously, to do of a lawyer is to assure that the law is followed. And they say for CIA, the law is there aren't many laws out there. So that's really did not take up an inordinate amount of time. It was largely, David, as I got more experienced, obviously in my early years, I was feeling my way along like any other new person in the intelligence world. But as time went on, and I was fortunate that I was in a position to observe and participate in each of the many crises and controversies CIA seemed to get ourselves into every few years. And I, in going through some of those controversies, like Iran-Contra in the mid-1980s, you try to learn lessons yourself, and you try to impart those lessons to your clients. Things like, the absolute need to be totally forthcoming with Congress to make sure Congress is informed about significant intelligence activities. Always be mindful of that. Be mindful of what we call blowback, the idea of conducting a covert operation, which, if leaked, could redound not only to damage, intelligence sources and methods, but also cause the CIA to get entrenched in yet another controversy. As I grew and developed and gained more experience, I tried to impart these sort of hard-won lessons on my clients, especially the newer and younger ones. I served three generations of CIA.
When you say clients, are you talking about agents in the field, or are you talking about the people, the political appointees? Who?
Well, really, everybody. I consider every CIA employee a client, beginning with the CIA director and all his top lieutenants, all the way down to the agents in the field, the intelligence analysts, there's a big, huge quota of them, the scientists, the administrative personnel. I consider them all clients, and I did my best to serve all of them equally and fairly.
I'm curious about workflow, paper flow. Would it be like a president or someone, a joint chief of staff or someone, would have an idea about something they wanted the CIA to do, and then they would memo you, and then you would work on something and come back to them with findings, and then eventually would there be a document that the president would sign authorizing the CIA to do this type of thing?
Yeah, now that's a fairly tidy summary of how the process worked, yeah. Presidential findings is an art form that was actually created by Congress in the mid 1970s, and it's basically how presidential findings start. And these are presidential findings to direct CIA to conduct covert action operations. The idea for a potential covert action operation wouldn't generally start with the president himself, but typically with the National Security Council. Serving under him at the White House, they would basically send a short memo over saying, this is what the president of the White House or NSC thinks we want to do overseas in the covert action realm. Give us a specific proposal on how you would implement that. I would take that information, and sometimes it's not any more detailed than what I just described, and try to craft a document called a presidential finding that would be sent to the president, in which the president would literally sign his name on the bottom, and that would basically be CIA's marching orders.
How general or how specific do you want these findings to be?
Well, it's tricky. You want them to be specific and explicit enough so that there's no mistake about what the president is directing CIA to do. You don't want a three-word presidential finding because, that, frankly, that's one way why, the CIA, protects itself, and to make sure it doesn't go off on some tangent that beyond what the president or other than what the president wanted. At the same time, you don't want to make them so granular, 7, 8, or 9 pages, for instance, that you hamstring yourself so that every little wrinkle that may come up in the future about an ongoing covert action program doesn't require you to run back to the White House and get another document. So it's a you know, it's a delicate sort of balancing act. And, you know, it's an example of what I was describing earlier about CIA lawyers, you know, having to be creative in crafting these kinds of things.
Do they have a sunset to where this finding will expire at a certain time and will have to be revisited? Or is this in perpetuity? Now the CIA has the authority to go into Angola and do XYZ?
Well, findings remain in effect after presidents leave office. They can't, of course, be any finding can be rescinded by a subsequent president, but it takes a specific order from that president rescinding the finding. I retired from CIA in 2009. There were still findings, presidential findings on the book signed by President Reagan from the early 80s that were still in effect, had been renewed by and reendorsed by subsequent presidents. So they don't just end when the particular president who signed the finding leaves office.
So is that the you do for the guy who shows up his first day, the new attorney at the CIA, you tell him, go read all the findings. That's your first job. So you know what we've done and how we do it.
Well, yeah, that's basically it. I should add that being responsible for presidential findings is not something some new kid lawyer gets when he first walks in the door. I mean, I didn't get involved until a few years after I arrived. They're obviously, you know, covert action programs. Presidential findings are very extremely high level and sensitive, and you need to have a little grounding experience in the agency and in the world of intelligence before you plunge into those kinds of things.
Speaking with John Rizzo, he's the author of the book Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. He served in the CIA as a lawyer for 34 years, saw a lot of crises and controversies. Earlier you told me you see all of the people, all the agents, everyone who works at the agency as a client. Valerie Plame, she's a former CIA agent. She was outed by Scooter Libby, and it was a controversy in Washington, D.C. Was she a client? Did she come to you for, like, hey, they put me in the paper. What do I do?
You know, actually, David, I don't remember ever meeting Valerie Plame when I was there. I mean, the CIA is a large organization, and I didn't deal with every single person there. But sure, she was a client. I was the acting head of the office when that leak occurred, and I'm the guy who referred the matter over to the Justice Department, the leak over there for investigation and prosecutions. Valerie Plame was a very capable, mid-level employee, but served well. And outing a CIA employee is never a trivial thing. So it was serious.
Where were you on 9/11?
Well, I was sitting in my office, which was on the top floor of CIA headquarters in Langley, with a clear view of the sky. I might add through large windows I had in my office. So, and I suppose I was like anyone else in the country at that time, just staring agape at the television in shock and horror.
Did you know immediately Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden?
Yeah. I mean, the drumbeat of intelligence had been ongoing for, at least a year before that, indicating small, shards of intelligence increasingly indicating that Al-Qaeda was planning some sort of major attack against the U.S. somewhere in the world. So, yeah, when the World Trade Center was hit, I mean, I didn't have any doubt.
And the Pentagon.
I didn't have any doubt, and no one who was involved in counterterrorist issues at the agency at the time had any doubt that it wasn't Al-Qaeda.
And so the pivot towards Al-Qaeda and trying to figure out if there were more attacks coming, how did that go?
Yeah, well, recall the atmosphere in the country in those first weeks and months after 9/11. I mean, the assumption was, the fear was that it wasn't a question of if there would be a second major attack on the homeland, it was when. So it was a atmosphere of extreme crisis, not just in the country, but inside CIA, and as a result, in the immediate post-9/11 aftermath, President Bush via presidential finding, tasked CIA to do the kinds of covert activities that, frankly, I had never encountered before in my 25 years here. So it was an extraordinary time.
John Rizzo, former lead attorney for the CIA, his book, Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. As you read it, you revisit many of these headline-grabbing stories. You see them from a different perspective. John Rizzo, thank you so much for joining us on The Source.
Thank you for having me, David. Enjoyed it.
And this is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you so much for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.